a lot of numbers of healthcare.
I don't have research like Jeff does. So we're clear.
Welcome to the Making Margin podcast. My name is Nick Foy. I'm the founder of Greenway Wealth Advisors, which is a fee-only financial planning firm based in the south end of Charlotte, North Carolina. To my left, actually, we'll do Allie first. To my right, the intelligent, the lovely Allie Crouch.
Hi.
The director of client experience with us here at Greenway. Allie, by the way, he's 9 months old now? 10 months old.
Nine.
She has a 9 month old named Elliot, who I heard cry for the first time recently.
It's pretty rare.
To my left is Jeff Eminger. He is our director of financial planning.
Hello.
Jeff has how old's Forrest now?
He's
a year.
One.
He just turned one.
Yep.
Okay. To celebrate his 1 year birthday, Jeff got goats. Well, sort of.
We did, yeah. We had goats to abate some of the kudzu in our backyard, and we cleverly timed it for his birthday, so we had a built-in petting zoo for the party.
Did you? The goats had names already?
They did.
And how many were there?
We had six.
Wow. So today we're going to talk about something that isn't necessarily an easy discussion, because it's ultimately an expense that is necessary and is burning a hole in a lot of people's pockets and emptying out their bank accounts, and that is healthcare broadly, more specifically health insurance, and the cost to insure your family, the cost for premiums and deductibles and out-of-pocket maxes and all those things. And there have been some really significant changes over the last few years. So we decided that now's a good time to talk through this, because open enrollment is pending, might be going on right now for many of you, and giving you a little bit of an overview of how we typically recommend people approach the healthcare conversation is what we wanted to do. Data. Last year, companies spent an average of $15,159 in premiums to cover a family of four, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, which is an increase of 51% from a decade ago. The average family of four paid a total of $7,726 in 2018, which is an increase of 67%. And of that amount, $4,700 was premium contributions for coverage at work, plus $3,000 in cost sharing, the deductible, co-insurance, and co-payments. A 67% increase from 10 years ago, which is pretty wild to think about. Employers still shoulder a big share of the premiums, and employees, if you have coverage through work, you have the advantage of paying premiums on a pre-tax basis as opposed to buying coverage elsewhere with after-tax dollars, which is kind of a crazy thing that there's no like advantage that we could just give individuals who are buying their own insurance, making that pre-tax. We'll talk through that a little bit. So in the private market, a family of four with annual household income of $80,000 would pay $7,888 per year in premiums for a silver plan purchased through the health insurance marketplace, provided they're eligible for a premium tax credit of $9,961 a year. So the premium tax credit, that's just money that you get as a credit on your tax return because you're relatively lower income. What are the breakpoints for a family of four? Do you remember somewhere around?
It's between 100 and 400% of the poverty line.
Okay.
And if you go $1 over, then all of a sudden your subsidy goes to zero.
If you go $1 over that 400% marker,
yeah.
Then subsidy.
There's some differences for states that have adopted like expanded Medicaid that changes the calculation, but most haven't. So,
without the credit, a plan for a family of four would cost just premiums close to $18,000 a year.
Yeah, and then for that plan, you're probably going to have a deductible.
That's pretty high.
It's $13,000
in
out-of-pocket, somewhere around that ballpark as well.
Yeah. So broadly, health insurance is intended, like the idea of having insurance for something is that it's supposed to cover something that's not necessarily that likely, but would be catastrophic if it happened, right? Like if you got really sick or if you're in a bad accident, those things aren't necessarily that likely. If you spend a lot of time in the hospital, but if they happen, they'd be really bad and they could be catastrophic and they could bankrupt you. But the way that premiums and out-of-pocket maxes are currently designed is that it could be catastrophic for a lot of people, even if they have insurance,
right?
Because the costs are so high.
Yeah, where a single event could prove catastrophic just because of how expensive it is and how much you have to pay on your own before the insurance company comes in and covers anything.
Right.
And that's not even catastrophic events. That's like having a baby. That's a planned thing.
Yeah. So, interestingly, a Kaiser Family Foundation, Cynthia Cox, she's the vice president there. She said that insurance companies get a lot of heat for raising deductibles and premiums. But if you look at what's driving healthcare costs year to year, it's the price of healthcare, the cost of doctor's visits, hospital stays, and that's what's really making those premiums and deductibles go up each year. So it's actually the cost of healthcare and everything that's involved with delivering it and all the different layers that are there that, according to Kaiser Family Foundation, is what's actually causing the increase in the cost of care.
There's a lot of administrative inefficiencies in our system. If you compare the U.S. to other like wealthy developed countries,
sure,
our costs are 5 times higher per person just on administrative costs alone. So that's not even providing care. That's just, you know, billing and fixing all those errors that they ultimately make,
right,
and things like that.
Right. What we're going to talk through today is what we think are some potential ideas, or some ideas anyway, that are out there to combat this, and then things that you can do in order to prepare, and what we think might be the magic bullet to combating rising healthcare costs. First question for both of you guys. Tell me about a medical bill that you received that was shockingly high. Go.
So when I found out I was pregnant with Elliot, I had symptoms that coincided with it being ectopic, which means that the pregnancy is in the fallopian tube rather than your uterus. And so that can be very dangerous. Because there was a chance of it being a very dangerous thing, my doctor office would not see me to do the ultrasound. They told me I had to go to the ER just in case it was what they thought it was. So we were in the hospital for, I don't know, an hour and a half. They did an ultrasound that they can do anywhere and found out it wasn't. It was something else that was causing the pain. But that same ultrasound at my doctor's office cost $30. At the hospital, our bill was $1,800.
That's wild for the same thing, just a different location. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, ours is a similar story. It was a ER visit. My wife slipped on ice this last winter.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
And hit her head really hard. And so,
same hospital.
Yeah, same hospital, actually. And we were in the hospital for 3 hours. And of that, 5 minutes max was with a doctor. And
I didn't even see a doctor.
Yeah, they didn't even really check her head very well, which is the funny thing for a head injury. They did a CT scan, and our bill was $4,000, something like that. And, you know, they can do those CT scans at an outpatient mm-hmm. center are a lot cheaper, but when it's a head injury, you don't really mess around with that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's one of those costs, like you said, you just have to do it. And then you kick yourself later because there was, nothing wrong, but,
better than the alternative of
better safe than sorry.
Yeah.
Right.
It seems that the hospitals are what's so expensive, because when I had to get an MRI for my neck, the insurance told me, like, make sure you request that it is at an outpatient procedure, because that exact same thing at a hospital is 3 to 4 times as much as it is anywhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of that, I think, is the hospitals are subsidizing the care for people that either can't afford it or don't have insurance by charging those people that can and do more. Right.
Yeah.
So, I was at a meeting with some folks from Atrium Health not long ago, and they said that they have $5 million a day through their health system in uncompensated costs, meaning $5 million every day throughout the entire Atrium Health system, which is a really giant health system, that people are receiving care that either can't afford to pay for it or aren't paying for it. That's a big number.
Yeah.
So that gets covered by charging people more
right.
if they can. So how do you... I don't know what the solutions are. We'll dive into that a little bit, but
how do I not pay my medical bills? Because I want that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You get to the point where you can't afford to. It's just like when people say, "How do I pay $0 in tax?" Well, you have no income. That's the easiest way to do that. Yeah. If you want to pay no taxes, just don't earn anything. So anyway, those are good. So here's our medic. So
wait, what about yours?
Yeah, I was about to.
Okay.
Yeah. So my son, who is 7 now, was born in kidney failure, spent his first 3 months in the NICU, and went on dialysis. we got a bill afterwards, and my wife would be better at telling the exact numbers. And when you start talking seven figures, it doesn't really matter what the numbers are, but it was in excess of $1.5 million. I don't remember what the total number was. And we thought back, and obviously she at the time was working at a bank that had decent insurance. And so, I mean, you know, they covered up to the out-of-pocket max we had to pay for, and the insurance covered everything above that and negotiated the rate with the hospital and whatever goes on behind the scenes in that murky world. And so that happened. And it was in excess, what did I say, $1.5 million? I think it was over $2 million, but she'd be the one to tell us. But we think back and we think, well, like they saved his life. Like there was work that was being done every day and whatever it cost, and the insurance company agreed to that with the hospital and everything was fine. And so I don't know what it should cost to spend 3 months in the NICU and get multiple surgeries and go on dialysis as an infant, but whatever it costs is a lot. But he received really high quality care and he survived because of it.
Yeah.
My daughter has broken her arm twice this year. Okay, she's 5. And so both times we've had to go to the ER to get the arm set. And then you follow up with the orthopedic doctors and they check on the arm and make sure that it's healing well and all that good stuff. Legitimately, at one of the first follow-up visit, it was a PA, I think, or maybe even a nurse practitioner. Maybe it wasn't even, I don't know. It wasn't a doctor. It was just a tech. It was a tech. They come out, wrap her arm with gauze, like around the cast, rewrap the arm to make sure that it's stable and whatever else and that there's no movement on her cast. And it took 5 minutes to do that. It was a simple procedure. The gauze, if I had watched this on YouTube, I could have done this myself at home. It would have taken me 5 minutes and would have cost me $3 in supplies. And we got a bill for like $450, including $50 in supplies.
Right.
Yeah, the gauze is $50. Yeah. And we're like, what? So it's this weird discrepancy between things that are really expensive, but you can actually see value that was added there for something I couldn't have done at home versus the things I probably could have done that at home. And I would have saved a bunch of money on it. So
I requested an itemized bill for our hospital for when I gave birth, which I don't recommend doing because it just makes you mad. But they charged me for being in labor. Like, we paid for the actual room. We paid for everything they did to me, and we paid for the care. There was a charge for labor, and then there was a charge for intensive labor. I just want to be clear that I am the only one that labored.
Yeah.
Like, none of the doctors labored. I wasn't paying them to do the labor for me, but I had to pay.
You mean that wasn't a credit back or anything?
Nope, nothing. But I had to pay to be in labor
I wonder when the separation point was. You're like, this felt intense the whole time, okay? Why did you?
Yeah. I don't know where they chose that, but yeah, lot of money too. It wasn't a little bit of money. It was a lot of money on the bill.
Yeah. Well, when you talk about how it's like a murky backroom situation between insurance companies and the hospital, like, there's nothing that's clear about healthcare pricing.
Right.
Like, you didn't see ahead of time how much that was going to cost. When we had our child, they come, you know, the day after the baby's born and they say $3,000, please. And it's just like, they take your credit card and go. And then later you can get an itemized bill and check to see that they've probably made some sort of billing error, which happens all the time.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like what you paid for, but where else does that happen?
Right.
Like, how do you not have, you do some repairs to your house, you get, you know, estimates from multiple people. So you can
never do it. And then,
So there's no like competition. And so, you know, those prices just keep creeping
and
up and up
tell
because
you what costs
they
money
can.
Either. Like I went when I had the flu in college and I went and they put something on. They were like, here, give me your finger and put like an oxygen thing or something. But there was no question if I wanted it or whatever. And we got the bill after and that cost $50 for them to put it on my finger. And I would have said no,
but I didn't
know it was going to cost money for them to put this little thing on my finger.
Right.
Yeah.
My neighbor is a GI doc. And I was talking to him about medical costs one day, and he says, I don't even know how much procedures that I do cost. Like, before, people will ask me, how much this costs? I don't know. You know, it just gets billed by the system, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah,
at a different rate, depending on whether you have insurance or not and who the insurance company is and all that stuff.
Yeah, so they can't care about that.
Yeah, and how can you figure out a solution if nobody knows what anything costs?
Yeah.
Like, maybe that's a solution, is just starting point, make them put their prices out there. Like,
yeah.
And then you can see, well, why are you five times as expensive as the guy down the road.
Yeah. Right. So that's a potential solution, is price transparency.
Yeah.
The other potential solution that exists out there that obviously some presidential candidates have talked about is this idea of Medicare for all, right? Yeah. That there's a single payer, that the government pays for everything, and that everything gets run through them. Talk to me about your thoughts for just a nationalized healthcare offer and whether that would necessarily improve things.
I don't necessarily think, I mean, we look at, I mentioned earlier, administrative costs are a big burden. So I can't imagine a large government hand on that is going to help with administrative cost. But what I do think is that we have to decide as a country, do we think healthcare is a right or a privilege? And when you look at the profits that are made, you know, insurance companies, I pulled some numbers, and there's a Forbes article back in August where like three of the top healthcare providers, or sorry, insurance providers, profited more than $1 billion in the last quarter. And that's a lot of money. When you see that, you know, healthcare deductibles have risen 162% in the last 10 years. United Health Group, $2.6 billion in earnings. And it's crazy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you think of healthcare as a right, then there should be some sort of minimum level. And we kind of do have that. Like we talked about, you know, emergency rooms are subsidizing people that can't pay, but there's no transparency. And maybe if those people had a little bit better healthcare, then the levels for the rest of us would be more reasonable.
Right.
Well, and I think that there needs to be like clinics and things, because I know when we were admitted to the hospital for to give birth, there was a family in front of me that were there and at the ER, and the little girl had a sore throat. Like that's what she said, like, yeah. I had. And so they were in this, and they said, we were here last week for my sister who had the sore throat. And so like, that is way too expensive to be in an ER. They need to be at a local clinic, but like, that's not, the education on that isn't good. It's not, yeah, there. And so, yeah, those families that don't know that there is a step between the ER and, you know, having, yeah, a sore throat, like that's not an ER visit.
Sure.
But they didn't know that.
Yeah. One thing that both systems in Charlotte have done is put up a lot more urgent cares for that reason, but it's not even, that's not even like an urgent care visit.
No,
it's better in the urgent care than it is in the ER.
That's a CVS visit. Yeah. But, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I've always thought that like the idea of nationalizing that could lead to a lot of potential issues that we don't necessarily foresee. Like it sounds great in theory, but the reality is that most of the research as far as like medical advancements is done in America. And it's because people make investments in things because they have a profit motive, and they say, well, and, you know, pharmaceutical companies pharmaceutical companies, medical device companies, those sorts of organizations, they're making really significant advancements. Like healthcare has gotten better since 1980, right? Like the quality of care, and we've made a lot of progress on cancer, and we've made a lot of progress on heart disease, and these items have gotten better. And you'd expect the cost to go up for that. Like you wouldn't necessarily expect the cost to go down for as much advancement as there's been. And so there needs to be continued investment in the research and in development and improving those things. But if the government takes it over, then all of a sudden you lose that profit motivation.
Yeah.
And so in a lot of ways, like we're subsidizing. When we look at Canada and their drug prices, and people talk about how much cheaper it is there, and so we should go to Canada, we should go to a model where the government limits the prices under. The reality is like we're subsidizing that because the drug company has a profit motive.
Yeah, so what would happen to those countries if that wasn't happening here?
Yeah, yeah, know? Exactly. Like would they be able to balance it out better?
It's the unintended side effects of... unintended consequences of making changes like that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so I think thinking very clearly through that stuff. But from a personal level, what we talk about with a lot of our clients is how do we combat that? Like how do we get people to plan for these very realistic, very hard to estimate expenses? We don't know what healthcare is going to cost 5 years from now, let alone 35 years from now. And a lot of the people that we're working with, we're planning many decades into the future. So talk to me, Jeff, a little bit about sort of what our conversations look like there around offsetting and hedging future healthcare costs.
Yeah, so we talk about health savings accounts a lot. What I think about it is controlling what you can, right? So we can't control what healthcare prices are going to do. We can't control what legislation is going to be passed other than, you know, voting for the people that have the ideas that we think are better. And so health savings account is a way that you can reap some tax benefit to save money into an account specifically for health. It grows tax-free if you're using it for healthcare expenses. And so with our clients, we talk about, you know, how can we make that HSA budget balance as large as possible so that when a healthcare event does arise later on down the road, that they have something to fall back on.
Yeah, the health savings account, I think, is a really powerful tool that a lot of people are not taking advantage of. Either they don't know about or they don't have the right type of healthcare plan, insurance plan, in order to be eligible for it. So in order to be eligible for a health savings account, you have to have a high deductible health plan, and they're pretty clearly marked now on your plan. It'll say HDHP, HDHP, and it'll say HSA on there too, HSA eligible or something like that. For 2019, as an individual, your contribution limit on a health savings account is $3,500. For a family, meaning if there's more than one person, the contribution limit is $7,000 for 2019. If you're 55 or older, you can increase both of those by $1,000. And the health savings account is the only type of account with a triple tax benefit, where your contributions are pre-tax, any earnings in it are tax-free, and if you take the money out and use it for healthcare costs, then it's a tax-free withdrawal. There's nothing else that's like that out there. And so the potential to have a relatively large health savings account can have a major impact on offsetting those future healthcare costs that you might incur. You can't use it to pay for premiums, but you right. can use it for basically any medical cost.
And what we talk to our clients about is that you can invest your HSA. If you are able to kind of cash flow until you hit your out-of-pocket max, then you can save that and think of it long-term and invest it into something that's earning more than cash or right. a money market or something like that. And that's how you really reap the benefit long-term. And then if you have something that comes up in the interim that you can't pay for out of your cash flow, well, then you have essentially a healthcare emergency fund
right.
that you can tap into.
Tax-free.
Yep.
And so, HSAs are different than FSAs.
Yeah, so an FSA is a flexible spending account, which is, again, pre-tax, a lower limit on how much you can put in there. But you have to use it by year end. Otherwise, it doesn't carry over. But as far as actually like building health savings dollars, it doesn't have as much utility.
Yeah. Health wealth.
Health wealth.
I think one of the scary things for people is looking at the deductible numbers year after year. And I think that's where the government could have a hand in keeping those numbers more in line with what's reality. Because if we look at, I was looking at a survey of costs, and wages over the last 10 years have risen on average 2% a year.
Yeah.
Premiums are up 5.4% a year, and deductibles are up 16.2% a year.
Yeah.
And so when you look at that growing disparity, and it is growing year after year, it's scary, but I think the tax benefit of making the HSA contribution is overlooked a lot. And that if you run the numbers, generally comes to break even or even be a little bit better. So,
yeah, well, a lot of our clients will talk to them, I have the highest premium plan, but it offers me the most coverage. And we do an analysis. And for most people, even really heavy medical users, having a high deductible plan with an HSA that you max out on an after-tax basis, even before factoring in the growth that can happen on an HSA, you're probably better off. And yeah. people overlook that when they're thinking about it.
I think where it's harder is in if you're not a high healthcare user, but maybe just like a medium, because you end up getting like maybe close to your deductible or yeah. close to your out-of-pocket every year. And right. it's like, you know, I didn't really get any benefit. So that's where my family ends up a lot, is like close to the deductible. And then it's like, wow, I just paid all these premiums and reaped really no benefit because I still paid for all the bills, you know, fully.
Yeah. Your company probably has an HSA option. Most large companies anyway do. If they do, you might want to use it. A lot of companies will also give a credit into an HSA, like $1,000 or something, in order to encourage you to do a high deductible plan. Sometimes it's more than $1,000. The trouble is that most people end up just leaving it in cash. And if you leave it in cash, it doesn't earn anything and you don't end up benefiting as much as you can from it. So the recommendation there is to make sure that it's at a place either where it is currently at your company, or if you move it to another institution, you can transfer an HSA at a place where it actually can be invested. So we usually recommend Lively to our clients. Lively is a fee-free HSA platform, and you can tack on a TD Ameritrade brokerage account to it. And TD Ameritrade lets you then invest the money into whatever's available through their brokerage platform.
So that's not an advertisement.
That is not an advertisement. Yeah, we don't get it. We don't get compensated by either of them. I just think it's a good option. HSA Bank and Lively are the two places I know of that allow you to do that. Some health savings accounts have like a lineup of funds that you can invest in directly, but usually, you know, having a brokerage account gives you some more flexibility as far as the way it's invested.
One thing I do like about what some companies are doing with HSA contributions is that they tie it to meeting health metrics, mm-hmm. or doing wellness things. So if you're not, like, they had this where you could go in and do a biometric screening. If you didn't meet enough things, then you can sign up and do like health coaching, and you can work with a nutritionist, and they give you money into your HSA for that.
Quite a bit too.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things that our healthcare system is very reactive, and it's great for caring for people that are already really sick, but we're not so great at keeping people from getting really sick.
Yeah.
And so how do you incentivize it? Well, that's one way, is pay people to have healthier habits.
Yeah. At some future point too, we'll do a whole podcast on long-term care insurance, which is another dry, boring topic that we'll try and make interesting. But it's good planning information in the who needs long-term care insurance and why. And this is another one of those things to help us offset the risk of medical costs that continue to rise. And it makes sense for some people and doesn't make sense for other people. If you talk to the long-term care insurance salesman, it makes sense for you. But it may or may not actually make sense for you. So we'll talk through that.
Yes.
Thanks so much for joining us today on the Making Margin podcast. On our next episode, we are going to talk about retirement and encouraging you to never retire. Thanks so much.